Le Rendezvous de la Francophonie is back for 2026. My name is Catherine Fisher, and I interviewed 8 Canadians for the Franco podcast. In this episode, I spoke with Marie-Ève Fontaine, theater artist and artistic director of the Théâtre Cercle Moyer in St. Boniface, Manitoba. Marie-Ève and I spoke about her theater background, the Cercle Moyer's storied 100-year history, and its future as a gathering place and a place for fun in the community. Here's our conversation.
You're the artistic director of Le Théâtre Cercle Moyer, which has just celebrated its centennial. Can you tell us more about the theater and its rich history?
Absolutely. So it was founded 100 years ago by 3 gentlemen from the community. 2 of them were, I think, originally from Europe, and one was from Quebec. So they all settled in St. Boniface. And they founded the company at a moment where French was banned from schools. So one of the intentions of the company was to, keep the culture going. And really for the first, 50, even 60 years of the company, it was run by volunteers, just passionate people from the community who really enjoyed making theater and were passionate about the French language and wanted to keep that going. And I think from the get-go as well, there was also the intention of connecting with the Anglophone community. Because we're a minority in Manitoba, we live with English people every day. So instead of going in a contrarian kind of direction, they kind of wanted to create that relationship. So through one of their first artistic directors, Pauline de Tade, who was a really well-known visual artist in the English Anglophone community, they really started... the artistic communities would mix. So that's really lovely. And so in I think 1967, Roland Mahé, who was the third or the fourth artistic director of the company, came into the artistic position, and he kind of professionalized the theater at that point. So the arts councils, the Manitoba and Canadian arts councils, were kind of getting set up at the time, and funding was becoming available for theater companies. And during his 44 year tenancy as artistic director, pretty long one, but he managed to get the company to be from semi-professional to professional. So the actors and the designers are nowadays professional, and they get paid for their work. And then we also offer training to the community and kind of encourage and promote professional and community involvement in the arts.
How has the Cercle contributed to the cultural life of the Francophonie in Manitoba and in Canada?
Yeah, I think it's huge, actually. I think that it's probably one of the, I like to say that it's one of the major organs of the community. First off, because at the time it was founded, French language was going through a rough time in the province. So they kind of kept that going. And I think it really became like the kind of a role model for Francophones, and also how to maintaining the language and the high level, like Pauline Boutal, who was Roland Mahé's predecessor. She was there for 27 years. And she put a lot of importance on the verb and the words and the diction and the level of French. So for the whole time that she was there, and her husband was her predecessor too. So the first 50 years was basically Pauline and her husband, Arthur. They were French. They were both from France, from different regions. So the company would put up mostly productions that were from the French repertoire, if you will. And then with Roland Mahé's arrival, he kind of started to switch it up. So there was a major play that happened in Quebec in the 60s called Les Belles Sœurs by Michel Tremblay. And it was the first time that there was a play, that presented the French-Canadian language on stage. Before that, we weren't represented on stage. So that was a huge turning point for Quebec and also for us, because we presented that play a few years after it went up in Montreal. And it was a revelation that we could be ourselves on stage. And that's was when the Franco-Manitoban dramaturgy really took off. Guaramae started investing in artists who had things to say and who got comfortable writing in a real language that we speak, which sometimes is Franglish. And so that was a huge turning point for the company. And I think that for a long time, people have looked up to Le Cerf Molière and have come in to see themselves on stage. And we're now at a new turning point now because the community is changing a lot. There's a lot of immigration. We're getting a lot of immigration from the Francophone African countries. And the projections are huge. In a few years from now, most of the Francophone community will come from the African continent. So this is another turning point where the company kind of needs to adapt to that new audience, I think, so that they also feel represented on stage. And that is kind of tricky because, of course, the company was built by the Franco-Manitobans who were here, who have been here for a long time. And so now we kind of need to open up the space and share. And in the last decade, my predecessor, Geneviève Pelletier, has done a lot of work to include indigenous voices too, herself being Métis from La Rivière Rouge. And she really promoted the indigenous voices and perspectives. So it's kind of a balancing act now for me. It's making sure that the original audience feels represented, bringing in this new audience coming from the African and other regions of the world too, but international cacophony, if you will, and at the same time maintaining our link with the Anglophone community. About 10% of our audience comes from the Anglophone community because I think that we offer theater that is a little more cutting edge than what is offered by the Anglophone companies here in town. And it's just a culture thing. Just in French, we have a tendency where we get a little more funding so we can take more artistic risks. So some of the Anglophones who are a little artsier like to come to Cerf Molière as well. So that's kind of where we're at right now. It's a balancing act, I think, but I'm really focused on making Le Cerf Molière a gathering place for all of the community. So we'll see if I can help make that happen.
And how did you become involved with the theater?
I grew up in St. Boniface. I was born here, and my parents were very much involved in the cultural community from the get-go. My dad founded the Improv League, which is 35 years old this year, still going strong. So the Improv League is older than I am. My mom is a puppeteer and has worked a lot with schools and has put up shows that have poured across the province and across the country. So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, as they say. And Le Cerf Molière has been running a youth theater festival for the past 55 years. So we're on our 56th edition this year. And I started out, I did a few productions with my parents when I was a young kid. But I also, the Festival Théâtre Jeunesse was a really important moment for me because I was just, I think I was a natural at being on stage, and it comes from being around my parents and that kind of scene. But I just really liked it, and I pursued studies at the University of Ottawa in theater, and just really, really loved the kind of universe of all the theater references and how that like opens up to the world and how we kind of interpret the world through putting stories on stage and stuff like that. And in 2023, I co-produced a show with Le Cerf Molière based on a Gabriel Roy book. And it was a wonderful adventure. I play with my mom on stage in that show and with another wonderful musician called Gérard Laroche, who's a Franco-Manitoban superstar. And I wrote that show and we put it all together with Le Cerf Molière. So I got to know the team really well during that time. We developed it over 3-4 years and we presented it, and it was a pretty big hit, and we went on to go on tour across Canada, and we still have touring left this year. But it was an opportunity for me to prove myself as a an artistic leader, I would say, and also to collaborate with Lisette and get to know that machine, you know. And so when the job opened up, I had been away from Manitoba for 15 years and I was kind of ready for a comeback. But it's tough being a Francophone professional artist, theater artist in Manitoba. The only people I can play for are Lisette Maillard, and I can do my own thing. But then I like French theater. That's what I want to do. So when the job opened up, I thought, that's it. The universe is offering me this little opportunity. And it's really wonderful. I'm really looking forward to the next couple of years.
So this year's Rendezvous with Francophonie theme is Activate Your Francophonie. How do you activate your Francophonie in everyday life?
I think it's, I have to stay interested in learning new things and staying open about what it is to be Francophone and what is the French language and how much English are we willing to let exist within the way that we talk, and being really inclusive. I think, like, as I said, historically, the Chef Maillard has always wanted to kind of collaborate with the Anglophone community, and we kind of need the English community as well, because sometimes we don't have the right costume designer in our community. So we reach out and we kind of bring them in and we try to teach them a few words if they don't know any, and just be really, really welcoming about it. Because as a minority, if we want it to work, we have to be able to adapt and also create positive associations with this language. So I think that having a lot of fun in French, that's how I activate it. And that's kind of where we're headed for the next few years with our programming. We want it to be really fun. And it's been hard with the pandemic, and the world is changing right now. And, you know, there's a few things that are kind of hard to process and a little bit dark. But I think that the first thing is, if we have fun together, we're capable of doing really, really great things. So I think that's how I do it. And I make sure I create conditions for people to have fun in French in our theater.
Well, I really appreciate your time today, and I wish you all the best with your, I guess, 101st year.
Yeah, exactly. We're not so many people will be looking at us. It's going to be nice. I'm enjoying this one, but it's a wild ride. So I'll be happy to catch my breath next year. Merci beaucoup, Catherine.
Merci.
Bonne journée.
That was my conversation with Marie F. Fontaine, theater artist and co-artistic director of the Théâtre Cercle Molière, a French language theater company in St. Boniface, Manitoba, that has just celebrated its 100th birthday. This has been the RVF Franco Podcast 2026. Thanks for tuning in.
Bird Note. Millicent Ficken spent her career studying bird behavior and communication. The first woman to earn a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Cornell in 1960, Ficken authored over 100 scientific papers. She discovered that male hummingbirds have a whole repertoire of songs rather than just one, outlined the linguistic differences between penguin species, and showed that chickadees take turns singing in the morning. She was also fascinated by how birds play together. Play is one of the most mysterious activities of animals, Ficken wrote. Her seminal 1997 article, Avian Play, was an exhaustive attempt to categorize these behaviors. One example was the great frigate bird, a black seabird with a prominent red throat pouch. Ficken noted that young great frigate birds swoop, pick up, and then drop leaves or other floating objects. She compared it to a kitten playing with a ball of yarn and suggested it might help fledglings learn to catch jumping fish and even steal food from other birds. Ficken found lots of evidence for avian play. But unlike mammals, who sometimes play purely for fun or social bonding, she showed that bird play almost always has a more pressing purpose. They're practicing a skill they need to survive. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients in every blend. Available at Chewy.com.
Diverse. Independent. Yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Le Rendezvous de la Francophonie is back for 2026. My name is Catherine Fisher, and I interviewed 8 Canadians for the Franco podcast. In this episode, I spoke with composer, teacher, and former CBC radio personality, Pat Carab. Pat is from the village of Saint-Pierre-Joly in Manitoba and currently lives in Vancouver, BC, where he is the director of the Chan Centre for the Performing Arts. Pat and I spoke about his musical background and work, his experience as a 60s scooper, and his efforts to learn Michif, the endangered orally-based language of the Métis people. Here is our conversation. Pat, how did you get into music?
Oh, gosh, how did I get into music? Well, that was kind of random, you know? Like, I'm a 60s scooper, right? So I was adopted out and brought up by a wonderful family. And one day I just came home and said, I want piano lessons. You know, I was about 5. And nobody I knew played the piano or anything like it, you know, so it was kind of weird. And my parents said, okay, well, we're not going to buy you a piano yet. So I was going into like grade 1 by the time this was all organized. And I had to give up my recess for a year, basically, and go practice in the nuns' convent. And I kept doing it. So they went, okay, I guess we'll buy a piano. And I always really loved music, and I was drawn to it in a whole bunch of different ways. And, you know, you think when you're a little kid, you're probably more likely to be a pop musician or something, or maybe a public school music teacher. But as I got into university and started seeing other pathways, then I ended up going into the kind of more serious music.
And where has that taken you?
Yeah, it's been a pretty great life, really. I ended up getting a PhD from the City University of New York. I mean, I started out in Manitoba. I did my undergrad in Manitoba. Then I went to the Banff Center for a year. And then I did my master's at Western and got my PhD at City University. And then came back, you know, at that point, the Canadian dollar was even worse than it is now, if that's imaginable. And so after 3 years, we thought, now I guess we're going to come home. And I, you know, started freelancing a bit. And we organized our own concert series, and we started a music publishing company, and just a bunch of stuff. You know, we're young, we're going to do all this exciting things. And so it turned out that, like, by the time I was in my early 30s, I was already the dean of music at Brandon University. So I kind of started as the dean, which is a bit weird, but that's the way my life has gone. So. And I was at Brandon University for 27 years, did a lot of different things. I was composer in residence at the Winnipeg Symphony for 6 years. I was an on-air host for CBC for a couple of years. And I've always composed. And then in 2019, I got the offer to come out to Vancouver to be the director of the School of Music out here. And I just finished, not too long ago, a 5-year term of that. And now I'm running the Chan Center. So, my musical life is, even though I'm primarily a composer of what would be called fairly serious music, I've always been interested in popular music and stuff. So the Chan does mostly non-classical music. And the CBC show that I had was about the crossover between classical and non-classical music. So it's always been an interest.
You mentioned the 60s scoop earlier. Just if we have listeners that aren't familiar with that term or don't know much about it, sure. If you could unpack it.
Sure. Well, unpack it. Yeah, that could take a while.
Yeah.
A little bit. In Canada, I was born in 58. So I was in the pilot project, I guess. The Canadian government and the churches had a stated objective of trying to essentially get rid of Indigenous people. So they there was pretty regular adopting out and taking away of young children from Indigenous parents. So my mom is Métis on both her parents' side, and she was quite young, and so not a big surprise, but they ended up taking me away and adopting me out. And that was kind of organized by the church, but also by family services. And I tried to connect to my birth family when I was in my early 30s, and that wasn't possible then. But they did give me some identifying information, and some of the, you know, I mean, just I cringed when I read some of the file about my birth mom, because I was fortunate to reconnect with her later, and she was quite lovely, but she had just been told she was a bad girl and didn't know her responsibility to God, more or less. And so life was not so easy for her. I was very fortunate to be, you know, adopted into a really nice family. But now I've reconnected with my whole Métis family. So I've got four sisters and another brother who was also adopted out. So it's a complicated situation, and it's very common in Canada, particularly, I mean, even within my adopted family, my older sister, my adopted sister, her and her husband adopted a Cree girl when she was quite young. So, I mean, it was quite common for people who couldn't have kids or wanted to help kids or whatever. A lot of times it didn't work out very well, but I was super lucky.
So you released a cycle of three works called Métis Songs, Songs for Voice and String Quartet. Can you tell me more about these songs and why you chose them?
Yeah, sure. That was a really fun project. I got a call from Harbourfront in Toronto, and they wanted something that kind of spoke to my Métis heritage. So I was particularly interested in starting with, there's a very interesting composer by the name of Pierre Falcon, who was kind of the Métis bard of Red River, and he wrote a lot of songs. And so I wanted to take one of his texts and then kind of redo it for myself. And then there's a really wonderful Métis poet named Gregory Schofield, who teaches at the University of Victoria, that I had met. And so I wanted to do something of one of his songs as well. And then in the middle, there's a very famous line from Louis Riel, who was the kind of father of the Métis people, where he says, "My people will sleep for 100 years, and then they will wake because of the artists." And so I kind of wanted to do something that was it's a vocalese. And it was really fun to do that project. So I helped to curate the whole concert, which included several other Métis composers and a Métis singer, as well as almost, I mean, my two kids played in the string quartet. So there was a lot of Métis going on.
You mentioned to me earlier that you're learning Métis. How's that going?
Well, it's a slow process. I'm in Vancouver now, and I don't know a fluent Métis speaker out here. So it's mostly been online courses, which has been a lot of fun. I mean, I took two online courses last year, and the two wonderful cookums or grandmas were delivering the course, and it was just like being back home. So even though I grew up adopted out, a lot of the kids in my neighborhood were Métis. So I knew them, I knew their families, I know the sound of the language. You know, people weren't speaking it a lot, but I certainly grew up with the sound of the language, which is primarily Cree kind of words with really Manitoba French pronunciation of French words. So it's not Parisian French, to say the least, and it's not even Quebec French, which, I mean, it's very hard dialect, which is kind of fun. I mean, the challenge there, though, is the spelling drives me absolutely bonkers, because they spell everything phonetically. And so I look at a word like, I wrote a piece called the Dilo, but in Métis it's spelled D-I-L-O-O, but it means water. And, you know, so it's just like I look in, you know, so I learned a fair bit of French when I was growing up and in school and stuff. And I did French reading for my musicology courses and stuff like that. But so I look at the words and then I go, oh, geez, that's just a normal word that I would be able to say if it was spelled properly, but no, it's not going to be spelled properly. So I have a couple of apps on my phone where I can look words up, and you know, you can do a little practice and stuff. So really now it's trying to figure out how to build my network of other people who are trying to learn Machif, because there's a lot of us who are trying to learn it. I mean, I think there were 500 people signed up for this online course with the Kukums.
So my understanding of Machif is it has a lot of different dialects, some more French-based, maybe some English-based. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So my family's from a little town called Saint-Pierre-Joly, just outside of Winnipeg. And it was more of a French Machif. So there's three main dialects. There's a French Machif, there's a Southern Machif, and there's a Northern Machif. And so I'm learning, trying to learn more of the Southern Machif, because I spent most of my time more down in that Southern area, and it just made more sense for me. My home Métis area is still Brandon, because I was in Brandon when I registered, and most of them there speak Southern Machif. But from the Kukums, they were talking about, oh, I went to Edmonton and I couldn't understand a word anybody was saying because I'm not from there. I'm from Southern Saskatchewan, you know. So it's a little bit challenging. I do have a lovely French Machif dictionary that I bought, and that was put together. There's a really nice project at the University of Winnipeg where they've recognized the different types of Machif, and they're starting to put dictionaries together and stuff. The Louis Riel Institute has a couple of apps out that allow you to pick Southern Machif or French Machif. But again, you know, the French Machif is really just Manitoba French with a really hard accent and not the best grammar.
How has learning Machif enriched your life?
Oh, it's I really enjoy it. I mean, partly it's when you grow up adopted, you don't really have any culture to claim. You know, you can't really claim your adopted parents' history. So, you know, really since I've been connected back with my family and I'm a registered member of the Manitoba Métis Federation, you know, so that just helps me to feel grounded more in where I'm from and who I am. And I mean, out here in British Columbia, and I'm on stage still a lot introducing concerts, and it's very normal here. And back home in Métis circles, it's very common that you have to say who you are, where you're from, who your family is, you know, what your territory is, what your job is, all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where I am in learning and being able to express who I am and where I'm from.
Have any of your kids been interested in learning or?
Well, I think my kids are both musicians, and my son is in Montreal, so it's pretty hard for him there because they don't even really want to know about Métis, right? For them, we're Francophones, we're French, and that's been one of those challenges, even getting recognition of the fact that there are Métis. He has a sash. Like, we do have some of our cultural things that, and he just recorded a piece of mine called Red River, a cello sonata that should be out soon. And so he's premiered and commissioned works by me and by other Métis composers. Our daughter is out here, and so she's actually become a little more interested in traditional Métis fiddling because she's a violinist. So I think her energy is more spent trying to learn some jigs.
I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, no, my pleasure.
That was my conversation with composer, teacher, and former CBC radio personality, Pat Carabra, who grew up in Manitoba and currently lives in Vancouver, BC. This has been the RVF Franco Podcast 2026. Thanks for tuning in.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.